and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, December 4th, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline for today's paper is A Holiday Classic Returns, Siouxland Civic Dance Association's Nutcracker Coming to the Orpheum by Earl Horlick. Dateline, North Sioux City. On Sunday afternoon, the 5678 dance studio was full of party guests, toy soldiers, dancing mice, and a human-sized nutcracker. That was because Rebecca McNamara was in the middle of the final dress rehearsal for the Siouxland Civic Dance Association's production of The Nutcracker. An annual tradition for more than 40 years, this year's production will be performed at 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday at the Orpheum Theater, 528 Pierce Street. With Melissa Strong, McNamara took over the Siouxland Civic Dance Association after the nonprofit's longtime director, Shirley Dill, retired in 2019. "This is the third time that I've staged Nutcracker by myself," McNamara said. "I'm either crazy or I love the show." After all, the production is a huge undertaking that involved around 100 young dancers from 11 different Siouxland dance studios. So, is McNamara, who began as a Nutcracker cast member when she was 7 years old. "Tchaikovsky's music gets to me every year," she said. "It just says the holidays are coming." Elizabeth Avery, who plays this show's heroine, Clara, agreed. "If you go, what?" The Siouxland Civic Dance Association's Nutcracker. When? 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Where? The Orpheum Theater, 528 Pierce Street. "I love the way the show makes me feel," Avery, a 13-year-old from North Sioux City, explained. This is the second time that Avery has appeared in the Siouxland Civic Dance Association's version of Nutcracker. However, it is the first time for Sophie Whitcomb, a 14-year-old Sioux Cityan who plays one of the dancing dolls. "I'm not nervous at all," she said. "I've been dancing since I was 2, and ballet has always been my favorite." Like Whitcomb, this is Archer Small's first Nutcracker. Although Small, a 14-year-old from Akron, Iowa, had taken dance for 5 years, his involvement in the show wasn't entirely voluntary. "My mom talked me into doing the show," he explained. "Mom said they needed dancers, and I said, okay." But in his role as one of the party guests, Small does little or no dancing. "I'd say my part is limited to that of classy walking," he said. "I get to walk in a classy way across the stage a lot." Auditions for the Nutcracker started in mid-August. The kids, as well as a handful of adult cast members, have been rehearsing on a weekly basis since late August. "This is a big undertaking for the students who have to juggle homework, sports, and other dance competitions in order to do our show," McNamara said. Despite being a yearly event, McNamara changes things up to keep the ballet fresh. "The Nutcracker is very adaptable," she said. "We can make each year's show unique." Having said that, some things must remain the same with the ballet, which was first staged in 1892. The show still involves a Mouse King, a Sugar Plum Fairy, all set one Christmas Eve. "Because of Shirley Dill, we've had moms and dads who were of Siouxland Civic Dance productions of Nutcracker when they were children," McNamara said. "Now their kids are part of the cast. It wouldn't feel like Christmas without the Nutcracker," she continued. Next is this story, titled Council to Vote on Headington Park Splash Pad by Dolly A. Butts. Dateline Sioux City. The Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to approve plans, specifications, form of contract, and estimated cost for construction of the Headington Park Splash Pad project. The city's consultant's estimated cost for the project is $400,000. JEO Consulting Group Incorporated of South Sioux City completed the plans and specifications for the project at the park at 2951 Isabella Street. The project includes new construction of a splash pad and general site work, earthwork, sodding, sidewalk construction, and concrete slabs, according to city documents. The documents state that the project will include bid alternate 1 for exterior benches around the splash pad and bid alternate 2 for the installation of umbrella structures around the splash pad's exterior. The project was originally bid on April 18th, but no bids were received. City staff worked with JEO to modify the scope of the project to extend the completion date and remove the splash pad's features to be bid separately. Sioux City Parks and Recreation Director Mac Salvatore previously told the Journal that he thinks the lack of bids and high construction costs for recreational projects are due to American Rescue Plan Act funds that have flooded the market. The project was rebid on August 8th. Christensen Construction Company of Pender, Nebraska, submitted the sole bid of $755,000. Since Christensen's bid was well above the estimated cost of $400,000, the council voted to reject it. During its November 20th meeting, the council voted to adopt the plans, specifications, form of contract, and estimated cost for the splash pad. Before the vote, City Manager Bob Scott asked Parks and Recreation Manager Angel Wallace if the city has ever applied for an Economic Development Authority grant for a splash pad. Wallace responded that her department has not. "You might want to do that going forward, just to see," Scott said. Rebidding the project includes the removal of the precast building and its foundation. Bids will be received on December 19th. The project, which is expected to be fully completed by October 15th, 2024, will be funded with general obligation bonds and covered under the Capital Improvement Program's Aquatic Comprehensive Plant, which has a total budget of $559,968.38, according to the documents. Salvatore told the Journal that residents living in the neighborhood requested the splash pad at Headington Park. The city currently has 5 splash pads, which can be operated longer than the swimming pools. Splash pads are open from Memorial Day weekend through Labor Day weekend daily from 10 a.m. until 8 p.m. In addition to those splash pads, the city also has a new water feature at Chris Larson Park's Floyd Plaza. Misters and fountains rise up from the ground with a push of a button. The fountain is operational during park hours, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. The next story is displaced by fire. Sioux County Church sees big crowd on Sunday. Triple Box event space in Orange City burned last week. By Mason Doctor. Dateline Sioux Center, Iowa. Activation Church displaced from its former worship space this past week by a fire at an Orange City venue saw one of our largest crowds ever Sunday morning in Sioux Center, Pastor Mike DeYoung said. The church, formed in the Sioux Center home of Michael and Jenna DeYoung in 2020, had hosted weekly services at the Triple Box, a popular event space outside Orange City, since Reformation Day, October 31, 2021. Before that, DeYoung said, we were preaching in fields and barns and you name it. In the early morning hours Thursday, law enforcement arrived at the home of Justin and Vicki Schrock. The Triple Box, which they operated on an acreage south of Orange City, was on fire. Burned to the ground, it's a complete loss, Schrock told the Journal. On a typical Sunday, Activation Church attracts 100 to 150 worshipers. DeYoung said the church was an orbit of 200 to 300 people. The church had, in effect, 3 days to find a place if services were to be held on Sunday. And the church found a place roughly the same size as the Triple Box at the House of Missions and Equipping, which DeYoung described as a house of prayer at 101 19th Street Southeast, Sioux Center. Honestly, we had one of our largest crowds ever this Sunday morning, DeYoung said, and we had about 10 to 12 college students receive Christ today for the first time. At present, the church has no definite plans for a future space, though DeYoung said that in the next few weeks, a plan should be taking form. We're in prayer. We're this week just really kind of praying about that direction, whether we're going to be renting a space or We have had thoughts of purchasing a building as well, DeYoung said. So we're just truly leaning in this week for direction from the Lord. The future of the Triple Box is similarly unsettled. During the course of a year, the venue typically hosts roughly 145 events, on average four a week or so, weddings, reunions, company events, and the like, Schrock said. After the fire, the family had to notify quite a lot of people that their scheduled events couldn't go on at the Triple Box as planned. We were about 85% booked for 2024, Schrock said. The state fire marshal examined the wreckage Friday, Schrock said. An electrical malfunction is suspected of being the culprit, though that's not certain. The Schrocks are meeting with their insurance agent Monday. How that pans out might play a role in determining next steps, said Schrock, and he wants to see how the building's cement foundation fared. We're not afraid to rebuild. We're just going to have to wait and see, Schrock said. Like a lot of people in the world, we might have been underinsured. The Triple Box was formed about 7 years ago when the Schrock family completely retrofitted an existing 162-foot by 48-foot cattle shed on their acreage for an event center, complete with a licensed catering kitchen and bar. I always joke, since I had five daughters and one son, that I'd be money ahead if we had an event center, Schrock said. Many of the decor pieces in the Triple Box were special things, Schrock said, the kinds of things that are difficult to replace. Everything had a story, as he put it. Their bar was an old checkout counter from a downtown Orange City clothing store, believed to date back to the 1920s. There's nothing salvageable, he said. It's crazy. Turning to the Nation and the World page, Israel expands offensive. Khan Yunus, Gaza Strip, is the dateline. The Israeli military said Sunday its ground offensive had expanded to every part of Gaza and it ordered more evacuations in the crowded south, while vowing that operations there against Hamas would be no less strength than its shattering ones in the north. Heavy bombardment followed evacuation orders, and Palestinians said they were running out of places to go in the sealed-off territory bordering Israel and Egypt. Many of Gaza's 2.3 million people are crammed into the south after Israel ordered civilians to leave the north in the early days of the war, which was sparked by the October 12th Hamas-led attack in Israel that killed about 1,200, mostly civilians. The United States estimates that 1.8 million Gazans have been displaced. Nearly 958,000 of them are in 99 UN facilities in the south, said Juliet Toma, director of communications at the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. After dark, gunfire and shelling were heard in the central town of Deir al-Baha as flares lit the sky. In Gaza's second-largest city of Khan Yunus, Israeli drones buzzed overhead. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk urged an end to the war, saying civilian suffering was too much to bear. The health ministry in Hamsaran, Gaza, said the death toll there since October 7th has surpassed 15,500, with more than 41,000 wounded. The ministry does not differentiate between civilian and combatant deaths, but said 70% of the dead were women and children. A health ministry spokesman asserted that hundreds had been killed or wounded since a week-long ceasefire ended Friday. The majority of victims are still under the rubber, Ashraf al-Qidra said. Fears of a wider conflict intensified Sunday when three commercial ships in the Red Sea were struck by ballistic missiles fired from Houthi-controlled Yemen, and a U.S. warship shot down three drones in self-defense during the hours-long assault, the U.S. military said. Responsibility for the attack was claimed by the Houthi rebels, who are backed by Iran. The attacks marked an escalation in a series of maritime attacks in the Mideast linked to the Israel-Hamas war, as multiple vessels found themselves in the crosshairs of a single Houthi assault for the first time in the conflict. Hopes for another temporary truce in Gaza were fading. The ceasefire facilitated the release of dozens of the roughly 240 Gaza held Israeli and foreign hostages in exchange for Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. But Israel has called its negotiators home, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the war will continue until all its goals are achieved. One is to remove Hamas from power in Gaza. Senior Hamas officials, Osama Hamdan, said resuming talks with Israel on further exchanges must be tied to a permanent ceasefire. This story is titled Talks Focus on Human Health. Changes in Weather Patterns Increase Spread of Disease by Jamie Keaton, Dateline, Dubai, United Arab Emirates. With planet Earth running a fever, UN climate talks focused Sunday on the contagious effects on human health. Under a brown haze over Dubai, the COP28 summit moved past 2 days of lofty rhetoric and calls for unity from top leaders to concerns about health issues like the deaths of at least 7 million people globally from air pollution each year and the spread of diseases like cholera and malaria as global warming upends weather systems. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said it's high time for the UN conference of parties on climate to hold its first health day in its 28th edition, saying the threats to health from climate change were immediate and present. Although the climate crisis is a health crisis, it's well overdue that 27 COPs have been and gone without a serious discussion of health, he said. Undoubtedly, health stands as the most compelling reason for taking climate action. After 2 days of speeches by dozens of presidents, prime ministers, royals, and other top leaders in the background and on stage, participants were also turning attention to tough negotiations over the next 9 days to push for more agreement on ways to cap global warming at 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit since pre-industrial times. Pope Francis, who was forced to abandon plans to attend because of a case of bronchitis, said Sunday that, "Even from a distance, I am following with great attention the work." In remarks read at the Vatican by an aide, the Pope called for an end of what he called bottlenecks caused by nationalism and patterns of the past. Protests began in earnest Sunday at COP28. In one, a group gave mock resuscitation to an inflatable earth. "Well, I mean, it's cheesy doing CPR on the earth," said Dr. Joe Vipont, an emergency room physician from Alberta, Canada, who took part. "We're kind of in a lot of trouble right now," he said, "so we'll do anything we can to bring attention to this issue." Saturday capped off with conference organizers announcing that 50 oil and gas companies had agreed to reach near zero methane emissions and end routine flaring in their operations by 2030. They also pledged to reach net zero for their operational emissions by 2050. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the promises made clearly fall short of what is required. In comments Sunday, he called the methane emissions reduction a step in the right direction, but he criticized the net zero pledge for existing emissions from fossil fuel consumption, where the vast majority of the industry's greenhouse gases come from. "There must be no room for greenwashing," he said. Germany's climate envoy, Jennifer Morgan, said Sunday that the oil and gas industry needs to go beyond just cutting emissions that are generated to make those products and splash emissions from indirect activities too. "It's 2023, the former Greenpeace International co-director said. "I was already speaking to Shell about this in 1998. Next, we have report. Surrendering Ukrainian soldiers shot dead by Felipe Dana and Joanna Kozlowska. Dateline Kyiv, Ukraine. Ukrainian officials on Sunday launched an investigation into allegations that Russian forces killed surrendering Ukrainian soldiers, a war crime, if confirmed, after grainy footage on social media appeared to show two uniformed men being shot at close range after emerging from a dugout. The video shows the servicemen, one of them with his hands up, walking out at gunpoint and lying down on the ground before Russian troops appear to open fire. It was not immediately possible to verify the video's authenticity or the circumstances in which it was filmed, and it was unclear when the incident took place. The Ukrainian General Prosecutor's Office on Sunday launched a criminal investigation hours after the Ukrainian military's press office said in an online statement that the footage is genuine. The video shows a group in Russia, in Russian uniforms, shooting at point-blank range two unarmed servicemen in the uniform of the armed forces of Ukraine who were surrendering, the prosecutor's office said in a Telegram update on Sunday. The Russian Defense Ministry did not immediately respond to an emailed request for comment. As of Sunday evening, there were no public statements from the Russian government or military on the video. Kyiv, its Western allies, and international human rights organizations have repeatedly accused Moscow of breaching international humanitarian law since it launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022. The Kremlin denies these allegations. Now turning to the Digest column. Muslim leaders vow to end support for Biden. Dateline Chicago. Muslim community leaders from several swing states pledged to withdraw support for U.S. President Joe Biden on Saturday at a conference in suburban Detroit, citing his refusal to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Democrats in Michigan warned the White House that Biden's handling of the Israel-Hamas war could cost him enough support within the Arab American community to sway the outcome of the 2024 presidential election. Leaders from Michigan, Minnesota, Arizona, Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania gathered behind a lectern that read, "Abandon Biden, cease fire now," in Dearborn, Michigan, the city with the largest concentration of Arab Americans in the U.S. Biden's unwillingness to call for a ceasefire damaged his relationship with the American Muslim community beyond repair, according to the Minneapolis-based Jelani Hussein, who helped organize the conference. Former U.S. ambassador accused of aiding Cuba. Dateline, Miami. A former American diplomat who served as U.S. ambassador to Bolivia has been arrested in a long-running FBI counterintelligence investigation, accused of secretly serving as an agent of Cuba's government, the Associated Press has learned. Manuel Roca, 73, was arrested in Miami on Friday on a criminal complaint, and more details about the case are expected to be made public at a court appearance Monday, said two people who spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity. One of the people said the Justice Department case accuses Roca of working to promote the Cuban government's interests. Federal law requires people doing the political bidding of a foreign government or entity inside the U.S. to register with the Justice Department, which in recent years has stepped up its criminal enforcement of illicit foreign lobbying. And briefly, Alaska Airlines. Alaska Airlines said Sunday it agreed to buy Hawaiian Airlines in a $1.9 billion deal, including debt, putting it on track for a potential clash with a Biden administration that has shown wariness about higher fares in the industry. Florida Republicans. Christian Ziegler, the chair of Florida's Republican Party, says he will not resign over a woman's allegation that he raped her, saying in an email to supporters that he is innocent. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis called for Ziegler to resign. Wrongful death. Odeh Alfoumi, the father of 6-year-old Palestinian-American boy who was fatally stabbed in what authorities allege was a hate crime, filed a wrongful death lawsuit last month against Joseph Zuba, 71, the suburban Chicago landlord charged in the attack that left his child dead and the boy's mother wounded. Pope Francis. For a second Sunday, an ailing Pope Francis skipped his popular window appearance to the public in St. Peter's Square, but in televised remarks said he's doing better even though his voice wouldn't let him read all his comments aloud. climate protest. Thousands of people marched through the center of Brussels, Belgium, on Sunday in a boisterous rally, highlighting the dangers of climate change. "We must save our planet. It's the only one where there's beer," read one sign. Earthquake toll. A powerful earthquake that shook the southern Philippines killed at least one villager and injured several others as thousands scrambled out of their homes in panic, officials said. Now we turn to the lifestyles and entertainment page and this article on gardening. It's titled "Must Have Mini Vistas" by Norman Winter. If there's Supertunia vista, were the diamonds of the petunia world for their toughness and perseverance, then surely the mini vistas would be the rubies and sapphires as so demonstrated this year. Mother Nature gave gardeners all the challenges they could handle from the standpoint of heat and drought. The Supertunias seemed up to the task from the get-go. Young's Plant Farm gave an update on their trials throughout the summer on social media, and at the end of July, they took our breath away with the photos of Supertunia Mini Vista hanging baskets. I kid you not, the photos made them appear almost as large as Volkswagen Beetles. I took photos in June at their annual garden tour, and they were huge then, but the late July pictures almost defied logic. But what they said about their Instagram post said it all. The Supertunia Mini Vista is the perfect petunia for hot, humid climates like ours in the southeast. In fact, check out these pics from our trial garden. These pics were taken this week, end of July, and these mini vistas still look amazing. At the Garden Guy's house on November 27th, Supertunia Mini Vista Scarlet, the ruby of the group, which is new this year, and Mini Vista Sweet Sangria, new next year, are both putting on a new flush of blooms. This is what son James and I have both seen in past years with the performance of Supertunia Mini Vista Indigo. Also new this year is Supertunia Mini Vista Yellow, providing that color so rare in petunias and nonstop performance too. Supertunia Mini Vista Midnight is another new selection for this year. The color is so dark you might first think you can't use it, but it has won top performer in the South in Mississippi and Georgia and far north to Minnesota. The award that caught my eye was director's Select Best Performance at Penn State. Son James used it in partnership with Luscious Marmalade Lantana, which was stunning. But the proven winner's recipe called Victoria Lake is a wow. It features Midnight with Superbina Whiteout Verbena for the ultimate in contrast, and then the addition of Superbell's Twilight, a double calibrachia, which gives a soft echo of the Midnight's deep purple and the white of Superbina Whiteout. Next year is also the debut of Supertunia Ultramarine. This is my choice as the sapphire of the series. This purple color that some compare to Supertunia Royal Velvet Petunia seems to have an iridescent or glowing aspect to it. I partnered mine with the Solania Apricot Begonia, and it was magical. I predict this variety will literally fly off the shelves, so don't hesitate in your decision-making when you shop next spring. There are 10 varieties in the Mini Vista series, and they all will reach about 12 inches tall with a 24-inch spread. The Garden Guy has all of this in his containers with great potting soil, while Young's Plant Farm had baskets, containers, and raised beds where they all performed like champs. The Garden Guy fed his plants a water-soluble fertilizer mix every 2 to 3 weeks. As you make your plans, or as you shop next spring, don't let the words Supertunia Mini make you think the least bit diminutive or anything less than the champions they are. Their trophy case is enormous. Look at Young's Plant Farm Instagram page and you will see what I mean. Meanwhile, follow me on my Facebook page at Norman Winter, the Garden Guy, for more photos and garden inspiration. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, December 4th, 2023, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. There are no obituaries, so we will turn to the sports page. At the top of the sports page, we have college football playoff, Michigan, Bama, Washington, Texas set. Florida State left out of Final Four by Ralph D. Russo. The final section of the four-team college football playoff turned out to be the most controversial, with an unprecedented snub. Michigan, Washington, Texas, and Alabama were selected Sunday, and Florida State became the first unbeaten Power 5 conference champion to be excluded from the field. Michigan will face Alabama in the Rose Bowl. Washington will play Texas in the Sugar Bowl on January 1st, and the winners will meet for the national championship January 8th in Houston. Before the CFP grows to 12 next year, an expansion that was delayed by a year because of infighting among the conference commissioners who manage the postseason system, the selection committee faced the toughest decision in the 10-year history of the format. Florida State is a different team than they were in the first 11 weeks, explained Boo Corrigan, the selection committee chairman, who is also the athletic director at North Carolina State, Florida State's Atlantic Coast Conference rival. The Seminoles, 13-0, lost star quarterback Jordan Travis to a season-ending injury 2 weeks ago, but continued to win with a backup and then a third-string quarterback. The committee, though, is instructed to judge teams for what they are heading into the playoff and decided FSU without Travis is not among the best four in the country. I am disgusted and infuriated with the committee's decision today, but to have what was earned on the field taken away because of a small group of people decided they knew better than the results of the games, what is the point of playing games? Florida State coach Mike Norvell said. He added, what happened today goes against everything that is true and right in college football. A team that overcame tremendous adversity and found a way to win doing whatever it took on the field was cheated today. It's a sad day for college football. Travis is a sixth-year player whose development into one of the best quarterbacks in college football has fueled Florida State's resurgence over the last 3 years. Devastated, heartbroken, Travis posted on the social media platform X. I wish my leg broke earlier in the season so y'all could see this team is much more than the quarterback. I thought results matter. 13-0, and this roster matches up across any team in those top four rankings. I am so sorry. Whichever team was left out had a good argument to get in. That created unprecedented controversy, and the committee passed over FSU to pick Alabama, which upset Georgia to win the Southeastern Conference Championship, and Big 12 champion Texas, which beat the Crimson Tide on the road in September. Now turning to the NFL recap. LaPorta leads Lions past Saints. Dateline New Orleans. Sam LaPorta had career highs of 9 catches for 140 yards, including an early touchdown and a crucial first down snag in the final minutes, and the Detroit Lions defeated the reeling New Orleans Saints 33-28 on Sunday to post their best record through 12 games since 1962. The Saints lost quarterback Derek Carr in the fourth quarter to back, shoulder, and head injuries. Carr was hurt on a penalized hit by Bruce Irvin, who drove the weight of his body into the quarterback. Jared Goff passed for 213 yards and 2 touchdowns for the Lions, who raced to a 3-touchdown lead and then held off a valiant comeback by the Saints. New Orleans fell one game behind first-place Atlanta in the league's weakest division, the NFC South. After falling behind 21-0 in the first quarter, the Saints pulled as close as 24-21 late in the third. The Saints also had the ball at midfield with a chance to take the lead in the final 3 minutes, but turned the ball over on downs when Jameis Winston threw behind Chris Olave. 49ers 42, Eagles 19. Brock Purdy threw for 314 yards and 4 touchdowns. Debo Samuel scored 3 touchdowns, and Eagles quarterback Jalen Hurts was checked for a concussion in San Francisco's win over Philadelphia. The fiery NFC Championship game rematch also featured 49ers touchdowns on 6 straight possessions and a pair of ejections that showed this year's title game might not run again through Philly after all. Texans 22, Broncos 17. Nico Collins had a career high 191 yards receiving and a fourth quarter touchdown, and Jimmy Ward intercepted Denver's Russell Wilson in the end zone with 9 seconds left to help Houston hold off the Broncos at home. Ward leapt in front of intended receiver Lucas Kroll to secure the fourth victory in 5 games for Houston and snap a 5-game winning streak for Denver. Colts 31, Titans 28 in overtime. Gardner Minshew threw a 4-yard touchdown pass to Michael Pittman with 2 minutes and 31 seconds left in overtime, and Indianapolis won at Tennessee for its 4th straight victory to keep pace in the playoff race in the AFC. The Colts had to score a touchdown after Nick Folk made a 46-yard field goal with 4 minutes and 19 seconds left in overtime to put Tennessee up. Indianapolis came in holding the 7th and last spot in the AFC. Falcons 13, Jets 8. Desmond Ridder threw a 20-yard touchdown pass to McCole Pruitt as Atlanta took over sole possession of first place in the NFC South by slogging its way past punchless New York on a dreary rainy day in East Rutherford, New Jersey. The Falcons have back-to-back wins for the first time since opening the season with victories over Carolina and Green Bay. Atlanta entered tied atop the division with New Orleans, which lost to Detroit. Dolphins 45, Commanders 15. Tariq Hill had 2 touchdowns among his 157 yards receiving, and Miami routed host Washington to pad its lead atop the AFC East and get to 9-3 for the first time since 2001. Tua Tagovailoa was 18 of 24 for 28 yards, including touchdown passes of 78 and 60 yards to Hill, the NFL's leading receiver, left wide open on his 11th and 12th trips to the end zone this season. Tagovailoa was turnover-free after giving the ball away 4 times over the past 2 games. Chargers 6, Patriots 0. Justin Herbert threw for 212 yards and set up a pair of Cameron Dicker field goals that were all visiting Los Angeles needed on a cold and rainy day for its first shutout in 6 years, beating New England and its latest hapless quarterback, Bailey Zapp. Cardinals 24, Steelers 10. James Conner ran for 105 yards and a pair of touchdowns against his old team as Arizona beat the Steelers, the franchise's first win at Pittsburgh since 1969. Buccaneers 21, Panthers 18. Tampa Bay's Mike Evans scored on a 75-yard reception and joined Jerry Rice as the only players in NFL history to string together 10 consecutive seasons with 1,000-plus yards receiving while helping the Buccaneers beat struggling Carolina at home. Rams 36, Browns 19. Matthew Stafford threw 3 touchdown passes. Puka Nacua became the first Rams rookie wide receiver to reach 1,000 yards in a season, and Los Angeles extended its winning streak to 3 games by beating Cleveland at home. Packers 27, Chiefs 19. Jordan Love threw for 267 yards and 3 touchdowns, and Green Bay defeated visiting Kansas City for its 3rd consecutive victory. Christian Watson had 7 catches for 71 yards and 2 scores. Now going to the college basketball top 25 recap. Late 12-0 run helped Southern upset number 21, Mississippi State. Dateline, Starkville, Mississippi. Ty Rion Joseph scored 27 points and blocked Mississippi State's final shot as Southern closed on a 12-0 run to stun the 21 Bulldogs 60-59 on Sunday. Down 59-48 with 4 minutes and 28 seconds remaining, the Jaguars took the lead with 23 seconds left on Brandon Davis's layup. With 3 seconds left, Joseph blocked Josh Hubbard's shot to hand Mississippi State its second straight loss. Joseph was 11 of 21 from the field. Davis had 12 points, 5 during the 12-0 run. Hubbard led Mississippi State with 14 points, and Cameron Matthews had 12. The Bulldogs also lost at Georgia Tech on Tuesday night in the ACC-SEC Challenge. Mississippi State led 9-2, but the Jaguars hung around the rest of the half and had several leads. Following Joseph's three-pointer, Southern led 19-17 with 7 minutes and 16 seconds remaining in the half. The Bulldogs closed the half on a 5-1 spurt to lead 31-28. Number 15, Creighton, 89, Nebraska, 60. Baylor Shearman scored 20 of his 24 points in the first half as host Creighton built a 15-point halftime lead on its way to beating in-state rival Nebraska. The Blue Jays, 7-1, trailed only twice, the last time with 10 minutes remaining in the first half. Creighton then held Nebraska to 16 points the rest of the half while hitting 6 three-pointers, 3 from Shearman, and 7 of 8 free throws to go up 52-37 at the break. Creighton, which avenged last season's 63-53 home loss to the Cornhuskers, stretched the lead to 21 on Stephen Ashworth's layup 4 minutes into the second half. Nebraska got no closer than 19 points the rest of the way. Creighton's largest lead was 31. The Blue Jays held Nebraska to 33% shooting, well below its 45% season mark. Nebraska's 60 points were its fewest of the season. Creighton hit 46% of its shots and 14 of 40 on threes. Number 22, James Madison, 130, Keystone, 59. Michael Green III had 21 points and 4 assists to lead 7 James Madison players in double-digit scoring as the host Dukes ran past Division III Keystone College. T.J. Bickerstaff had 12 points, 13 rebounds, 5 assists, and 3 steals in 16 minutes for JMU, which had 15 players score. Terrence Edwards, Jr., and freshman big man Jalen Carey scored 16 apiece. Deshaun Johnson led Keystone with 12 points. The Dukes had a 21-point lead midway through the first half, and the game quickly turned into a series of highlight reels for JMU before coach Mark Byington emptied his bench in the second half. Green hit a 13-pointer at the buzzer to give him 14 first-half points and make it a 63-30 halftime lead. JMU increased the lead to 45 points in the first 7 minutes of the second half and cruised from there, with walk-ons closing the game out for the Dukes. Now turning to professional golf, Scheffler rolls to a 3-shot victory in Bahamas. Dateline Nassau, Bahamas. Scotty Scheffler has made great gains in his putting. Add that to the rest of top-ranked game, and he made it look easy Sunday. He closed with a 4-under 68 for a 3-shot victory in the Hero World Challenge. Scheffler, a runner-up in the Bahamas the last 2 years, played bogey-free at Albany and didn't let anyone get closer than 2 shots on the back nine as he ended the year with his 5th victory worldwide. The Hero World Challenge is an unofficial event, though its 20-man field receives world ranking points, and Scheffler only solidified his spot at number one. The week wasn't a total loss for Tiger Woods, the tournament host playing for the first time since surgery to fuse his right ankle a few weeks after the Masters in April. Woods finished 72 holes for only the third time in the last 2 years. He has played 6 tournaments following the recovery from his February 2021 car crash in Los Angeles that badly injured his right leg. Just like I said to you guys on Tuesday, I'm curious what this is going to look like, Woods said. I haven't done it in a while. I haven't done it with my ankle the way it is now, and I was excited each and every day to kind of get through it and kind of start piecing rounds together again. I haven't done this in a long time, so it was fun to feel that again. Woods closed with a 72 and finished 18th. Sepp Straka had three late birdies for a 64 to finish second. Justin Thomas had a 67 to finish alone in third. It was his third straight finish in the top five dating to September. Scheffler led the PGA Tour in just about every important statistical category, off the tee, shots to the green, until he got onto the putting surface. He sought help from highly regarded putting coach Phil Kenyon and is starting to see immediate results. I played solid and kept my distance, Scheffler said. I was just trying to hit good shots and get as many looks as I could for birdies. Scheffler had not played since the Ryder Cup. This was his first 72-hole tournament since the Tour Championship in late August. He said he was optimistic about the work he put in with Kenyon before the Ryder Cup. It's nice to see some fast results, Scheffler said. It's paid off pretty good this week. Scheffler didn't make his first birdie until he chipped close on the par 5 sixth and then pitched up the slope on the drivable par 4 seventh to 2 feet. Straka, Thomas, and Jordan Spieth at times were poised to make a run. Scheffler answered with birdies at the right time to hold them off. He missed a birdie putt on the 17th from just inside 3 feet. It was his only miss inside 5 feet all week. Rarely is this holiday event without some measure of drama, and such was the case on Sunday. Colin Morikawa was given a two-shot penalty before he teed off for using material in a greens reading book on the fourth hole Saturday. Turns out his caddy had used a level on the practice green and put some notations in the book. According to new rules, such notes can only come from traditional methods without outside devices. Morikawa was informed 15 minutes before his round, frustrated because he says he has been told by other officials and caddies that it was okay. Apparently, if they tell you something wrong one day in a different tournament, it does not carry on, and I understand that. We made the mistake, Morikawa said. From our understanding, it was fine to use a level on the practice screen and see how putts break and write that down. Obviously, it's not. Morikawa, at 68, finished 7th. Woods was never in the mix after each round, which was not the primary objective. He knew there would be rust, and he felt he knocked a little off each day. But not all of it. He had a pitch roll back toward his feet on the par 3 second hole for a double bogey, and he hit another poor chip that led to bogey on par 5, 11th. Woods remained optimistic he could play one tournament a month in 2024. If you ask me right now, I'm a little bit sore, he said. Once a month seems reasonable. It gives me a couple of weeks to recover. Maybe I can get into a rhythm. That's what the plan was going into next year. I don't see why that would change. Now turning to sports, we go to the... I'm sorry, that was it for sports. That's the sports page, and we're going to turn to the music page called Holiday Hitmakers. Fill your stocking with Ella Fitzgerald, Cher, Brandy, Andrea Bocelli, and more. What is a holiday season without festive music? The classics are great, but the classics performed by some of the best performers across pop, R&B, rock, opera, soul, and beyond, that's a real reason to celebrate. In honor of the most wonderful time of the year, here are some of the best new holiday releases for your listening pleasure. Ella Fitzgerald, Ella wishes you a swinging Christmas. This collectible vinyl release of Ella Wishes You a Swinging Christmas gives us the hits. Ella Fitzgerald's 1960 holiday record is largely considered by critics to be one of the greatest of all time. So, why not celebrate the best of the best on a new piece of wax? It's not a bad gift idea, either. Cher, Christmas. Cher's first holiday album features a bunch of A-list collaborators, something she's never done before. There's Cyndi Lauper on Put a Little Holiday in Your Heart, Stevie Wonder on What Christmas Means to Me, Darlene Love on Christmas, Baby Please Come Home, Michael Bublé on Home, and even the rapper Tyga on Drop Top Sleigh Ride. There's something for everyone, and then some. Andrea, Matteo, and Virginia Bocelli, A Family Christmas. Italian opera singer Andrea Bocelli got the whole family together for a new deluxe edition of their first album together, A Family Christmas. Andrea, his 26-year-old son Matteo, and his 11-year-old daughter Virginia teamed up for the release, adding four new recordings to the collection: Let It Snow, Silver Bells, E Natale, and Winter Wonderland. Chicago, Chicago's greatest Christmas hits. Lifelong fans of the rock band with horns are familiar with Chicago's extensive holiday discography, but the only way to complete the collection, or begin your own, and with just the singles, is to check out Chicago Greatest Christmas Hits, which pulls from previous releases and is sold in festive red and green vinyl. Huidas, Just a Dirtbag Christmas. Far too often, holiday albums carry an air of seriousness, but the most wonderful time of the year requires moments of levity, as well as deep existential thought about the nature of love and family and what really matters on this earth. Enter Huidas, the 90s radio rock band best known for their ubiquitous hit, Teenage Dirtbag. Just a Dirtbag Christmas plays into the single's popularity, featuring a string quartet version of Teenage Dirtbag, as well as rewritten holiday-appropriate version of the song. Break out the bucket hat and the Yule log for this one. Brandy, Christmas with Brandy. For those looking for a seductive holiday album, the search is over. R&B great Brandy has released Christmas with Brandy, a collection of sultry and in other moments soulful imaginations of Christmas classics and originals, like on Christmas Gift, which features her daughter Siree and Feels Different. David Foster and Catherine McPhee, Christmas Songs. No strangers to holiday albums, the dynamic duo of David Foster and Catherine McPhee released one for the traditionalists among us, jazzy theatrical interpretations of Christmas classics that deliver a nostalgic satisfaction, amplified by their combined immense talent. Well, theirs and the skills of the Tabernacle Choir at Temple Square, whose reimagined Amazing Grace, arranged by Foster, is a song to behold. Luther Vandross, Luther Vandross Classic Christmas. Released nearly two decades after the R&B and soul giant's death, Luther Vandross' Classic Christmas is a short but memorable modern-day Christmas classic, a three-track EP built off the never-before-released At Christmas Time, May Christmas Bring You Happiness, and a special bonus a cappella mix of At Christmas Time. There's no better time of the year to hear the velvet voice do what he does best. And Allie Brooke, Under the Tree. All is fair in love and war and girl groups. Emmy Award winner Allie Brooke, formerly of Fifth Harmony, is back with a brand spanking new Christmas EP titled Under the Tree. Anchored by the shimmery retro pop title track Under the Tree is a Brooke original that is lighthearted, amorous fun. And it quickly does a 180, rounding out the track list with White Christmas, I'll Be Home for Christmas, and Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And that does it today for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, December 4th, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.